2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 163, Eternal Love, the Biblical Ideal for Marriage, a paper presented by Carrie Miles with a response by Molly Binion.
And I'm here to introduce Carrie Miles, PhD. Is that better? Is that too loud? Okay. Well, I'm going to introduce Carrie, but first they asked me to mention a couple things that we all need name tags or tickets if we're in here today. And from there, I just talked with her, and turns out she's a mother of two children. She's been married for 25 years. She's an organizational psychologist, and she graduated first from BYU and then University of Chicago for a Master of Arts in Social Sciences, and then University of Chicago in Illinois with her Doctor of Philosophy in Social and Organizational Psychology. She has published quite a bit with Sunstone, and I'm going to show you this. This is available now in the bookstore, and it's her one of her latest books, Male and Female in Christ. And she has one, and it's coming out. It's in the, with the publisher now, and that will be out. Okay, so that's in the works. Okay, and that was called Write My Name on Your Heart. Sorry, I want to remember that. Okay, so from there, she will be our main speaker, and then we have the response by Molly Binion, and I met Molly last night at the meeting, and she's from Seattle. She's an attorney in Seattle, and she's you're going to chair the Seattle Symposium, and I guess that's about it. Is there anything else you want me to mention?
Why don't you plug
dialogue? Okay. Okay, I'm a novice and just helping out, so I don't have all the background that I should probably for this. But I guess we'll go ahead and introduce Carrie.
Thank you. There's a handout by the door if you pick one up as you come in. Like many of the baby boomer generation coming of age in the 60s, Roger Scruton, an English philosopher, writes that as a young man he was urged to avoid marriage in favor of experiments with other kinds of sexual arrangements. And for him this included living with a young woman for a number of years. It was only when he discovered that his experiment with cohabitation had ceased to be an experiment and had become a commitment instead that he finally married. But like so many of his contemporaries, he found himself divorced within a few years. Our years of cohabitation, he wrote in explanation, had disenchanted our first love while leaving no second love in place of it. Scruton's distinction between first and second love captures an important insight, one that I find helpful in describing the biblical ideal for marriage. By first love, both he and I mean not your first crush, not the first person you fall in love with, but to love as it is in the beginning, romantic, passionate, sexual love. No one should die without experiencing that kind of love. But ironically, if we never grow beyond that initial passion, love itself will die. True, mad, deep, and passionate love is a great deal, but in the end, it turns out to not be enough. We also need that second love, a deeper love to capture first love, to domesticate it, and enable it to survive everyday life, to let love blossom into an ardor that endures when that first passion fails. And surprisingly, I've found that the Bible recognizes and provides for both our yearning for romantic, passionate love and our need for that deeper ardor that lasts forever. Together, these two loves create something that is truly eternal, for the Bible also promises that this ideal defies all earthly powers. I'm going to start with Jesus. And I'm going to end with Jesus, too. But Jesus starts the way. In Matthew 19, we have an account of some Pharisees coming to Jesus and trying to get him to say something about the grounds under which someone could divorce his wife. And Jesus won't talk about that. Instead, he talks about the ideal for marriage. And he says, in the beginning, God made them male and female, and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two will become one flesh. So the biblical ideal for marriage is as old as life itself, because the verses that Jesus quoted there are from the creation account in Genesis 2. And Genesis 2 explains why God created us as sexual beings capable of love. I mean, that's, you know, why sex? It's an interesting question. Biologists can't answer it. Why God created us as sexual beings capable of love by telling us this very interesting story about how in the beginning God started the process of our creation by making only one creature, only one individual. And that's Genesis 2:7. And then the Lord God formed man of the dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Okay? Now, your Bible probably translates the word for this first creation as man, and they'll call him Adam later. But the Hebrew word used here is not a proper name, and it doesn't mean male. Rather, Ha-Adam, or the Adam, is a title, perhaps even a pun, that was derived from Adamah, which was the Hebrew word for the earth, or the dust from which the first human being was made. The Adam is not Adam at the person at this point, but an undifferentiated human, or more literally, the earthling, or the earth creature. It's come from the dust, from the earth. Now, following each act of creation in Genesis 1, God pronounced his creation good. You all remember that. But after the creation of the single earth creature, God reversed this pattern for the first time. And he says, it is not good that the earth creature should be alone. I will make a help meet for him. So we have from the very beginning this account that creation is not complete with a single human being. The earth creature was lonely. It needed a companion, or in Hebrew, it's an ezer kenegdo. And I have this on your handout, both the Ha-Adam, or the Adam, and the ezer kenegdo. In the first widely used English translation of the Bible, of course, that's the one Mormons still use, the King James Version, these Hebrew words were translated correctly as help meet. The earth creature needed a help meet. But unfortunately, over a few hundred years, this rendering was corrupted into help mate. And that tends to be what we hear even when we read help meet. And that help mate is a nonsensical word, but it gives the impression that the ezer kenegdo was merely an assistant or a subordinate to the earth creature. Modern translations of the Bible don't help matters any because they translate the ezer as a helper. But this particular choice of words also implies inferiority, because a helper is someone we get to do things we don't want to do, like do the dishes or dig holes. No. And there is a word in Hebrew for such an inferior helper, but it's not the one used in Genesis 2. The first of the two words that is used in Genesis 2 for what the earth creature needs, ezer, refers to a help. Not a helper, but a help. This isn't a word that we use in English too much anymore, and in fact, my grammar checker flags this as ungrammatical, but this was a good English word. It's used 21 times in the Old Testament. Ezer is used 21 times in the Old Testament, and it refers not to a subordinate or an inferior helper, but to help which comes from someone who is superior. In most cases, the help is God himself, 18 out of those 21 times. Consider, for example, the ezer in Psalm 121. I lift my eyes to the hills. From whence will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. Or Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And in the few Old Testament cases where ezer does not refer to God, it refers to powerful equals, like kings coming to aid of other kings. Okay? So the ezer, then, this thing that God says the earth creature needs, is someone who is strong enough to render real aid. And it's this, not an inferior helper or a junior partner or a helpmate, it sounds like playmate, right? That God said that the solitary earth creature needed. The status of the help is further clarified by the modifying word kinegdo. And this is the word which is translated meet in King James English, and it means suitable, fitting, corresponding, or like him. And this word emphasizes the common nature and essence of the two beings. So what God said in creation that the Adam needed was not an inferior helper or even another God, but what the man needs is a help suitable for him or like him. Okay? So it's God said, it is not good that the earth creature should be alone. I will make a help suitable for him. Okay. So the Ezer, then, is someone who is strong enough to render real aid. So God and the Adam go looking for this Ezer Kenegdo, for the help suitable. And they look for it first among the animals, and it's this charming vignette. But not surprisingly, as thoroughly as Adam searched through the animals, the earthling cannot find his Ezer Kenegdo among them. And there's great sorrow in the words that follow. But for the earth creature, no help suitable for him was found. So the next thing that happens is the Lord God caused the earth creature to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took part of the Adam's side and closed up the place with flesh. And then the Lord God made a woman from the part he had taken from the man, and he brought her to the man. The man's joy in finally finding his Ezer Kenegdo and the depth of his longing for her is apparent in the manner in which he greets the woman. And a literal translation, on seeing his mate for the first time, the Adam says, "This one at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh." When he found her, he doesn't proclaim "Vive la différence," okay? But he said, "Here at last is someone like me." Okay? So he recognizes that the woman is not only made of the same substance of the man, she was made from his substance as well. She's made from his body, and it's not just a rib, it's his side goes to create the woman. So the earth creature, who's now an ish, he's now a male, joyfully greets his mate, and then we come to the critical passage. This is the one quoted by Jesus. And in fact, Jesus attributed these words to God himself. And he said, "The Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they will become one flesh." So here is God's intent in creating marriage. He created us to be like each other. What's important is not our differences, our different roles, the different, you know, things, our different behaviors, or the way we'll play different roles in life. We were created to be like each other. And the difference that God does create, sex and sexual desire, is not a difference that divides us, but one that draws us together. Okay. So in Genesis 2, one being is split into two, but for the purpose of becoming one again. And now these two creatures together have the ability to hold dominion over the earth. Genesis 2 answers the question of why God made us male and female, to meet the yearning for someone who is like us and yet different in just the right way, a way that unifies us even more. And the final verse in Genesis 2 concludes, "And the man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame." In its search for the Ezer Kenegdo, Genesis 2 began our education in the biblical ideal of two becoming one. The concept of being naked and not ashamed in that relationship will take us even deeper. For while it was literally true that the man and the woman were not wearing any clothes, the ideal is also psychologically true. We need to be psychologically naked, honest, and open with each other, and not ashamed and defended against each other in order to have this ideal relationship. Now, this is all that Genesis says about how we accomplish this kind of relationship. The next verses go right into an account of the fall. And in the fall, the advent of sin into the world, this beautiful unity and fearlessness between the man and the woman are lost. But the fuller explanation of the one flesh ideal can be found in a surprising place. the Song of Solomon. I'm going to call this by its real title, which is the Song of Songs. This is the title that the book itself gives it. And the Solomon attribution was probably made to give the book legitimacy because people couldn't figure out what this funny little book was doing in the Bible. It's been a scandal for 2,000 years. The song is infamous for its celebration of the sensual glories of first love. Okay, that erotic, romantic, passionate love. And theologians found this kind of embarrassing. But the poem's sensuality, I'm going to argue, is only part of its full and detailed explication of the soul-melding power of second love. And it shows us very clearly how this first love draws us into the process of becoming one flesh, naked and not ashamed. The Song of Songs is a poem or a song, and in fact, Jewish congregations will still sing it at weddings. It is set to music. So it's not a history, it's not an account of something that actually happened. There are two characters in the story, the lovers, who I call the woman, and the lover, who's the man. And there's a chorus of voices, usually called the Daughters of Jerusalem. And I'm going to briefly summarize the first half of the song. The first half of the song follows the lovers through the courtship dance. And in it we see first love and longing, this passionate craving for each other, writ large. It's just stunningly beautiful. As the story unfolds, the woman initiates. In fact, her very first words are, "Oh, that he would kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." She initiates, he pursues, they lavish each other with unbelievable praise, outrageous, glorious praise. They're blindly adoring. They sing their passion and longing for each other, and he asks for her commitment. And she goes back and forth about whether she's going to commit herself or not. Until finally we come at close to the end of the first half of the song, a passage, I call it the first vignette, and she says, "All night long upon my bed I sought him whom my soul loved." So she says, all night long I tossed and turned, thinking about this, and she finally decides to commit herself to him. She gets up in the night, goes out in the dark, looking for her beloved, passes the watchman on the city walls of Jerusalem, and says, "Have you seen him whom my soul loves?" And they haven't. So she finally finds him, brings him home to the house of her mother. Okay. And she publicly proclaims her love. And when at last the lovers come together, when their love is consummated, the lover proclaims that his desires have been fulfilled far beyond rational expectations. And he says, "I have come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I've eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." This abundant love-drunk consummation of passion is where the fairy tales and romantic stories end. They take us through first love, all right. But our culture urges us not to look too far beyond it, lest we find only a burned-out hulk of first love. And this is what Scruton was referring to, that living together without a commitment, their cohabitation, had burned out their first love. Okay, but in the Song of Songs, the first half of love takes us not quite halfway through the poem. The rest of the piece elaborates on the rest of love, a love that leads us to becoming one flesh. The second half begins with a vignette that parallels the one in which the woman goes out into the dark to look for her lover. In the second vignette, she is dreaming of her beloved when he comes to the door. And this is Song of Songs 5. "I was asleep, but my heart was awake. I heard my beloved knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and my locks with the drops of the night." And she said, "I'd taken off my tunic. Am I to put it on again? I had washed my feet. Am I to dirty them again?" So she's dreaming of her lover, but oddly enough, she greets his actual presence with annoyance and shame. This is the man who adores her, who had proclaimed that she'd captured his heart with one bead of her necklace. And now she doesn't want to let him in, because getting out of bed will dirty her feet. Her annoyance seems out of place, ungrateful, selfish, and vain. But before we condemn her, let's consider what she has to lose. Okay. Her lover has lavished her with adulation, praise for her beauty, praise for her grooming, praise for her beautiful clothing and ornaments. And he's just now called her his perfect one. Now think back to a time when someone thought you were perfect. Were you in any hurry to disillusion them? In the face of such thoughtless expectations, we're not going to thoughtlessly jump up and fling open the door. We're going to worry about, perhaps even resent, being caught ruffled and drowsy. And there was a letter to Ann Landers a few months ago, where a woman said, "Oh, I just met this man, and he really loves me, and I really love him. But the problem is he keeps telling me that I have the most beautiful blue eyes he's ever seen." She says, "Well, the problem is I wear contact lenses. My eyes are really brown, and I don't know how to tell him. You know, maybe he won't love me when he discovers that my eyes are really brown." Okay. So we all face this hesitancy. I'm sure you've all experienced that. Moreover, as the lover presents himself in the middle of the night here, he's no dreamboat himself. Curiously, the Song of Songs is not an epic poem in which the lover proves his worthiness by undertaking some ordeal for his beloved favor. Nor does she rescue him from some gratifying and thrilling danger. He comes to her in need, but his distress is hardly heroic. He has just gotten his hair wet, and now he rattles the doorknobs and pleads to come in out of the dew. His predicament isn't exciting, it's pathetic. Love's fantasies come crashing down. No wonder she hesitates to open the door. This is first love's crisis, then, and in it the song captures an important truth. In it, the lovers have to admit to themselves, as well as to the other person, that they are not perfect. As the first step to second love, they have to become naked. They have to trust in the other person's acceptance of them in their nakedness as they really are. And they have to accept the other person in their less than perfect state. So the second half of the song illustrates Scruton's point that cohabitation in the absence of second love can burn up first love. Up until now, first love has blinded the lovers to each other's flaws, allowing them to indulge in a fantasy of love perfectly groomed. Then came consummation, overwhelming love in a garden, but now everyday life makes itself known. And we all know that marriage involves adjustments to petty annoyances and disappointments, the toothbrush left on the bathroom sink, the sight of the object of our most erotic longings, coming to bed in ratty underwear and an old T-shirt. These disillusionments don't amount to much objectively, perhaps, but they do take that first eager romantic edge off a relationship. We lose not only our dream image of our beloved, but also of ourselves. So the Song of Songs celebrates our passion and our triumphs and then asks, now that you've seen the object of your longing from every side, now that you have been seen, do you still choose this love? And as the woman debates this question, the text goes on, my beloved thrust his hands through the latch opening, and my womb trembled for him. I rose to open to my beloved. She decides to let him in because her womb trembled for him. Scholars who read the song as merely an erotic poem interpret the woman's trembling womb as an expression of her sexual feelings for her lover. But from this point on, we can no longer understand the Song of Songs as merely an erotic poem. The Bible uses the image of a trembling womb many times, but nowhere else do translators consider it to mean sexual desire. Rather, the trembling womb is the Hebrew term expressing compassion. Okay. It's motherly womb love, the love of mother for child, and it's used often for God, God's feelings of compassion or love towards Israel and for his creation. And now it expresses the grace that a lover grants beloved, self-giving, caring concern for the other person for the other person's sake. And this is the beginning of second love. Caring, concern, compassion. So the woman has always desired her beloved, but now only when she desires him, when he is less than appealing and in need of petty comfort, that she can let go of her own fears, defenses, and resentments and give herself fully. Second love has asked the lovers to become naked, completely honest and accepting, and in compassion, this becomes possible. And now, fully giving, true marriage begins. The Song of Song, however, warns us that there's danger in our nakedness. And the poem, I'll go on from the one I just read. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh. My fingers dripped with liquid myrrh. Here's a sexual longing here. Upon the handles of the bolt. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My soul failed at his flight. I sought him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The watchmen came upon me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle, those sentinels of the walls. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this. I am faint with love. In the first version of this searching story, which took place before the woman had committed herself to her beloved, she passed the city watchmen unscathed. In the second version of the story, however, the watchmen beat her and take away her cloak, her mantle. What has changed? Only the nature of her love. Now, loving devotedly, she has opened her heart, and compassionate love renders her vulnerable in ways that eros, or passionate love, never could. Naked, searching for her beloved, opening her heart and reaching out to him, she is wounded. Here then lies love's terrible irony. Only without our defenses can love grow, but in this openness lurks a terrible danger. When we care about the welfare of someone else, his weaknesses and needs opens us to a new source of pain. I've never felt more vulnerable in my life than I did when my first child was born, because I had never loved someone who was so totally helpless before. A beloved without defenses cannot protect either himself or us. Now, the weaknesses of our husbands and wives rarely expose us to physical harm, but they do endanger us in many ways. Maybe she makes foolish investments. Maybe he craves a fame he can never have. They hurt and we suffer with them. When we truly love, we bear the burdens of each other's imprudent choices, vain ambitions, visions, anxieties, physical pains and ailments, character flaws, and even eventual death. And our recourse in the face of these dangers? The song simply asks us to receive them, to accept without defense the fact that our beloved's weaknesses exposes us to harm we cannot control. In the song, the woman does not attempt to control her beloved or to solve his problems. And like her, we can only say, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love. Second love asks us not only to be naked, but also unashamed, undefended and yielding, yes, but also fearless. This is very interesting because we're going to pick up this theme a few hundred years later in Paul, the writings of the Apostle Paul. Now, Paul isn't usually thought of as a great advocate of either women or marriage, but actually in Ephesians 5, Paul advises the entire Christian community to submit themselves for each other out of reverence for Christ. And he goes on to talk a great deal about what this means for the relationship between husbands and wife. And when he tells people to subject themselves to each other, he's not talking about passive submission, but a voluntary yielding to each other. What he's telling people in these verses is, don't try to retain the upper hand that you may have in this relationship. Don't try to control each other, but give up having your own way for the sake of each other. He's talking about compassionate love. And in fact, he goes on to talk about agape love, which is the Greek word for caring, concerned love, charity. It's translated in the King James English. Agape love is creating a place for each other where it is safe to be naked and defenseless. And Paul goes on to give detailed directions to husbands on how to love compassionately. And then he tells wives not to take advantage of the husband who has made himself vulnerable, to not use agape love against each other. Now, back in the song, While caring love exposed the woman to danger, I want you to recognize both in what Paul has said and in the song that the lover himself did not harm the beloved. She is wounded for his sake, but he doesn't wish the harm upon her. So the song warns us that we will suffer for our loved one's sake, but it neither condones nor accepts, tolerates abuse, nor does it ask for its passive acceptance. Compassion, unlike Eros, is purely voluntary. We cannot help whom we will desire, but we choose whom and how we will love sacrificially. Had the lover a tendency to hurt purposefully, the woman would have done well not to open the door. So we're never asked to be submissive or to accept subjection passively. Our submission to each other is, it's in Greek it's called the middle voice. We choose voluntarily to put ourselves under the other person. The woman has elicited the help of her friends in seeking her beloved after he's turned away, but she does not need their help. And the friends say, "Where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your beloved turn so we can help you look for him?" But the woman answers, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the bed of spices, to browse in the garden, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He browses among the lilies." The woman hesitated to open her heart fully, and indeed when she did, she paid a price for her exposure. But in her new weakness, her acceptance of the fears and concerns of truly loving, she has finally flung open the gates of the garden. When the daughters of Jerusalem ask her which way they should look for the lover, she tells them he has gone down to the garden, to the bed of spices, to browse among the lilies. He goes, however, not away, but to her. As the poem has told us earlier, she herself is the garden, the spices, and the lily. Naked and unashamed, the two become truly one. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Now, our modern culture tells us that we cannot possibly do this impossible thing, that we cannot not only adore, but trust and depend on a person whose weaknesses may hurt you. And we're not supposed to be dependent on each other. Women are certainly not supposed to be dependent on men. They're not supposed to submit themselves voluntarily or put someone else's welfare ahead of themselves. A dependent man is regarded, I think, these days as kind of laughable, if not, you know, potential stalker, someone who's scary. But the Song of Song goes on to show us that we can do this impossible thing by reordering our priorities. Throughout the song, and this is really striking, the lovers express no concern about any physical need. The song names the woman as lover, bride, and daughter of a nobleman, but she's never a housewife. Unlike the hardworking good wife in Proverbs 31, she bears no cares or responsibilities. Similarly, the woman calls the man beloved, bridegroom, and king, but he never acts the part of a husband with all the attendant worries. He does no work and provides nothing. In fact, she emerges as the provider and the protector in the song. Despite this lack of industry, however, the poem tells us that all fruit, spice, wine, and freedom is theirs. Now, the first verse of the Song of Song calls it Solomon's. The first line says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." This description did not intend to imply that Solomon actually wrote the poem. In fact, evidence suggests that the poem was written well after Solomon's lifetime. And nor is Solomon the lover. Rather, the poet alludes to the legend of Solomon throughout the poem in order to contrast the wealth of Israel's most glorious king with the even greater riches of love. Solomon, a ruler possessed of enormous wealth, power, and many, many wives, was shown in an earlier passage of the song to rely on men with swords to defend him and his possessions from the terrors of the night. That's a kind of ironic phrase, I think. But the lovers need no defenders. Unguarded, they go where they please, and they sleep outdoors in beds of henna blossoms under cedar trees, tasting air floating with exotic spices and intoxicating perfume. A sweet-smelling sachet, the lover lies all night between the breasts of a woman who knows he neither needs nor wants anyone, anything but her. She is to him all sweet and tasty things, a lily and the garden, a garden fountain, and a well of living water. To her he is pure gold, and his name is oil poured out. These are images of voluptuous wealth. So the song is asking us, invoking Solomon in describing the lover's freedom and simple abundance, the song is asking us, which do you choose? Would you rather own the world's most valuable material objects? Or would you rather have the person you adore regard you as the most precious thing in the world? Now, the song is a poem of love in a garden, and I admit that keeping your vineyard in blossom is easy when life is one long vacation. But this is exactly the point, that we realize our true abundance and fulfillment in unity and mutual concern, not in the pursuit of other wealth. Love, the song tells us, makes life a long vacation. Placing a priority on love frees us from anxieties and stress about acquiring other things. Now, how can this be? Well, just what is it that we need so badly? Achievements, possession, consumption, power, reputation? Isn't the drive for these things, in the end, no more than a yearning for love and acceptance? And if that's so, why not cast aside the things that ultimately don't satisfy and strive for love in the first place? The Song of Songs, a lyric love poem seemingly out of place in the Bible, in the end offers a very biblical message. Love and relationships, not material strivings, offer us a greater wealth than we even know how to crave. In fact, Jesus himself uses the images of the Song of Songs to make the very same point in the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus says, "Behold the lilies of the field. They toil not, neither do they spin. Yet Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more will he care for you?" So the Song of Songs then, as in creation, portrays woman as the Ezer Kenegdo, the help fit who makes the earth creature whole. She provides and protects, and in his only one, all he needs. But the protection she offers is not that of the sword, but of the comfort and abundance of her devotion. In the end, second love asks us to be not only passionate and adoring, but also committed and compassionate, fearless and trusting. And then, safe in each other, we can release our anxieties and find peace. And naked and unashamed, safe in each other, ardor becomes a thing of stirring power. Already we have seen how it provides for all of the lover's needs. In the Song of Songs 8, we go deeper still, where the woman says, "Set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death, jealousy fierce as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, a flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench, no torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned." In ancient times, people used seals, which were emblems carved of stone or clay, to mark their personal properties. Just as today, we put our names on things to mark them as ours. A seal also functioned as a signature to express one's assent or will. In ancient Hebrew thought, the heart conceived one's will or desire, and the arm carried it out. So what the woman is saying here, "and set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm," is write my name on your heart. There's a really beautiful ambiguity in this. If you write my name on your heart, then your heart is mine. But then, am I your heart, or is your heart mine? Let's try that again. If I write my name on your heart, then is your heart mine, or am I your heart yourself? And if I am your heart, does that make your will mine or my will yours? As a seal on your arm, do I blindly carry out your bidding, or do you ask to do only what I desire? Together, the lovers form an endless circle. There exists no object, no wealth, no power, no acclaim that they desire more than they yearn to be one with each other, to have the same will, to have their names written on each other's heart. Within this circle, even jealousy burns not as a possessive paranoia, but as the elemental longing for complete and exclusive allegiance. Intertwined, joined together by God and by our own choice, our own yielding, we become one in flesh, mind, and heart. And fearless love, which once exposed the lovers to harm, in its fullness renders them immune to all danger. For love is strong as death. It burns like a blazing fire, a flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench. The losses that we will all inevitably face pose a serious threat to any relationship. Our children struggle, a loved one becomes ill, we lose a job, our parents become old. The Song of Songs, however, promises that fully developed love indemnifies us against any material danger. God gives us marriage to provide a safe pasture, the pasture that we need to have to face down the challenges to our peace. Creation, Jesus, Paul, and the poet of the song all tell us that we need to desire only this unity. We need to defy the power of material deprivation and the anxious lure of material wealth. Then fire from heaven itself will meld us together. And now no one, not even the grave, can leave us bereft. The ultimate message, then, of the Bible is that Solomon, in all his glory, did not have what we have in love.
I've taught from the Gospel Doctrine Manuals for 16 of the last 25 years of my life, and none mentioned the Song of Songs. I read through rather than from around the text in defiance. And but it's been a few years since I've been a Gospel Doctrine teacher, and I really welcome the opportunity to go back and look at recent research and to have a chance to ponder Carrie's really very wise and thoughtful paper. For 2,000 years, the song has been viewed predominantly as an allegory. The Targum, written between 700 and 900 AD, is typical of Jewish writings from the song's first inclusion in the canon in the first century AD. The woman was Israel, the man was God, and their story began with the Exodus and ended with the coming of the Messiah, plus a couple of other historical allegories. With that in mind, Jews still read the song on the eighth day of Passover. Maimonides' work in the 12th century offered a competing interpretation substituting individual man for Israel as a whole. Levi ben Gershom, whose work has recently been reprinted and reviewed, followed with an Aristotelian explanation of the desired union between God, man, and this time, knowledge. I have slogged my way through his work, and it is labored, to say the least. Hippolytus produced the earliest extant Christian discussion of the song in about 200 AD. Surprise, the Christians saw the allegory as God's, sometimes as Christ's, relationship with not the Jewish, but with the Christian church. Origen met with Hippolytus in 215 and studied under the great Jewish scholar Hillel. It is Origen, schooled in both traditions, with his Neoplatonic and Gnostic belief in the incompatibility of body and soul, and his lifestyle so ascetic he chose castration himself, who established benchmarks of interpretation for Christians for centuries to come. Jerome and Bernard of Clairvaux carried on the tradition that the language of the song was so sexual it could only be interpreted as historical and spiritual allegory. The blatancy of the sexuality itself screamed of code. Not to ignore the Protestants, from whose ranks came the early Mormons, we note with interest Luther and Wesley differed very little from the Catholics. John Calvin, however, joined the historical minority to teach the song was about physical love and appropriate for the canon. In the last few decades, the trend of scholarship, both Jewish and Christian, has been an exploration of the literal meaning of the text. That meaning is intensely sexual and material. The song celebrates sensual love in all of its flavors. I may need some more. Sight, sound, smell, and touch. Thanks. And toward all its objects, flora and fauna of rich variety. Thank you. Such popular translations as the King James purposely downplay the sensuality of the original. For example, in the King James, a Hebrew word which specifically means sexual love is translated just love. Joseph Smith taught us to liken the scriptures unto ourselves. Few do with as much fervor and thought and wisdom as Carrie. I commend her. Her reading is personal and provocative. It is entirely appropriate to respond to the insights the scriptures lend to our individual lives, so long as we remain open to the possibility that while those may be God's messages to us and many others, they may not be the only insights or the insights intended by the authors. God uses scripture as well as many other avenues to touch our souls. I also find her understanding of the biblical importance of the marriage of equals convincing. Her concept that sexual difference serves to unite is profound. I find her argument for a deeper love than sex alone can express true with a capital T. Carrie's analysis mixes old and new modes of study. She accepts the sexual nature of the poem and finds a broader non-sexual meaning. Where I differ in my reading of the song and my understanding of its meaning for marriage is in a more literal reading of the text. I think the sexual nature of the poem is the broader meaning. The task of getting the Hebrew right, getting the translation into English right, and through it all maintaining the poetry can only be an approximation. I've read numerous translations and commentaries and note the very rational yet very differing treatments. I'm left with a humble guess, likened inevitably to me, even when I am trying to be objective. My personal favorite translation is that by Block and Block, 1995, Berkeley Press. Like Carrie, I prefer the New International to the King James, particularly because the former indicates the speakers. You can tell where the woman speaks, where the man speaks, and where the women of Jerusalem speak. Unlike Carrie, I cannot find a first and second half to the poem. Scholars have argued the poem is as many poems as one per line to only one unified whole. Most find the poem an assemblage of 1 to 3 dozen poems. They do not always seem to be in the right order. The sexual language is as strong in the second half as in the first. Even when in the second half, 7:13, the word for love relates to an emotional rather than a sexual relationship, it's followed immediately by the scent of mandrakes, the aphrodisiac. Both lovers describe each other sensually, pursue one another, and relish their tryst in her garden and his nut grove throughout the poem. The crisis incident can be interpreted multiple ways, but I'm most convinced by staying as close to the text as possible. Open to me, my sister, my love, the moistness of his body, his thrusting his hand into the hole of her door, hand arguably being a euphemism for penis, as in another place in Isaiah, and the door elsewhere being a clear statement of protection against sexual activity, if not virginity, and her reluctance to dirty her feet, feet being a euphemism for genitalia elsewhere in the scriptures, both male and female. All argue for her approaching her door expressly for sex and her reticence to engage in sex at the time. The literal translation for her reaction to his last move, thrusting his hand through the keyhole, is her innards stirred for him. Whether this is sexual longing, as Block and Block, among others, translate, or compassion, as Carrie prefers, doesn't really matter unless one finds the two mutually exclusive. I don't. Mixing the emotional and the physical seems natural, more common than not, and I believe the poem does so both explicitly and implicitly. Her love, perhaps both Eros and Agape, has overcome her hesitancy, and she moves to the door, but too late. Interestingly, in the latest issue of Bible Review, the renowned Robert Alter writes a piece on the Song of Songs, and he translates her reluctance to move to the door as simple coyness. Just another view. You can see there's a great divergence of opinion as to what this move means. It may be he urgently wishes to dry himself from the dews common in Judah at some times of the year, and it may be she's been ungrateful, selfish, and vain, but that reads a good deal into a text that more directly says, I want you, and answers not now. The word for the tunic she wears indicates a dressy and fine garment, and even possibly an undergarment, so I'm not sure she finds herself less than appropriately attractive. When she does open the door, and he is not there, she is crestfallen, and utters an expression elsewhere used for dying. Other translations might be, my soul failed at his flight, my soul went forth, or I nearly died. Remember, too, that in ancient Israel, soul meant both body and spirit. The Greeks and the Gnostics, not the Jews, contributed the pernicious doctrine that the body and spirit could only be at war. The woman's abuse at the hands of the watchman exacerbates but hardly daunts her. The poem glosses over the incident quickly and finally. It never's mentioned again. I'm also not convinced there wasn't a difference in the two incidents with the watchman. In the attack version, she wears a veil, a word for which is used only elsewhere in the Old Testament in Isaiah 3:23 to describe fashionable apparel worn by wanton women. The tunic garment noted above may be particularly seductive. Her dress could explain the attack. Nothing in the text indicates that she's made to suffer for selfishness or vanity. I don't see her heart close to him at any point in the poem, and I don't see it more open in the second half than the first. Everywhere these two adore each other and the world in which they find themselves. Throughout the poem, they take turns as the pursuer, and longing leads to pursuit, leads to discovery, leads to joy. There's little sense of time passing. The song may take place in days or weeks. It takes time and corresponding experience to develop all-encompassing love. Here I see no evidence of time, experience, or maturity. The lovers have no earthly cares other than a little extra sun exposure while guarding the vineyard, the watchman incident, and perhaps the threat of discovery. They speak only of love, and the love of which they speak is almost exclusively that of sexual attraction and fulfillment, only in two ways other than as physical pleasure, three times in warning and once philosophically. For instance, teaching the young women, she warns of the power of love. Swear to me that you will never awaken love before it is ripe. Love requires readiness beyond gonads, a point that Carey's made very, very well. Philosophically, late in the poem, in what some think should have been the final stanza, we read, "For love is strong as death. Jealousy pierces the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, a flame of God himself. Love no flood can quench, no torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned." Those caveats made, the song relishes the physical. Oscar Wilde once said, "Those who see any difference between body and soul have neither." I'm not sure all that Wilde had in mind with this clever ditty, but it speaks to me of basic Mormon doctrine. All is material. Material is good. The earth is good. The body is good. Sex is good. Marriage is good. The sheer newness, the curiosity factor of a beginning relationship must, as Carey says, develop into a commitment capable of weathering storms large and small. Physical attraction cannot carry the weight of a full life. There are brief intimations of that commitment in the song. Their love is faithful and exclusive. But from first kiss to last voice in the garden, the song remains intensely sexual. Praise be, for herein lies a truth the text speaks to me. The relationship which cannot sustain sexual passion as it takes on additional, essential characteristics of love is not to be envied. I love the song for the clear statement of God's blessing on sexual joy. It has been my experience that sexual pleasure softens the blows of life and binds husband and wife when the world would wrench them apart. The absence of sexual pleasure usually strains all other aspects of marriage. I don't want to de-sex the song, the only scripture to celebrate that truth. It's all we have. That's why in my gospel doctrine classes, we got to mention it a little. As Carey points out, we live in a culture most confused about love, sex, and marriage. Part of our confusion comes from the failure of religion to accept even one book of scripture which boldly and beautifully celebrates the unity of body and soul and the natural affinity of the material and the spiritual. Redemption is not about denying the body or discarding it for the eternities. It is about using the body for good, not evil, so that we earn the capacity to use it forever. The song sings of that good.
Well, we want to thank both Molly and Carey. You can tell I do this all the time. I want to thank both Molly and Carey for being here today. They're both very, very good. And we have about 2 minutes. Anybody have any questions?
We don't really know who wrote the Song of Songs. It probably wasn't Solomon because the Hebrew used in it is from the intertestamentary period, which is about 300 years before the birth of Christ. Solomon lived at 1,000, so we don't know who actually wrote it. Joseph Smith's attitude, of course, was that it wasn't inspired, and you know, I would disagree. I think we really need that song there. Did you have a question?
That was the question.
Mm-hmm.
But he left it in the canon.
That's true. Still in the Bible.
He didn't like it, but he left it.
Before he could take it out.
But he did work on the Old Testament.
He did, and he just skipped the songs. Actually, it has a pretty strong anti-polygamy message. Maybe that's why he didn't find it inspired. I don't know. Does anyone know the inspired version? He didn't get too far, I don't think. No. Yeah, I think the publication is only on the material he'd worked with, and I'm sure it's not the entire Old Testament.
No, and then what Professor Matthews put into our Bible is a whole other, treatment of the Ark. We're through?
Thank you very much, and there'll be tapes of this session in the near future, a couple hours.